I'm excited to invite you to the Reset Your Nervous System Super Conference, a very special free online event happening July 21st through the 27th, 2025. During this one-of-a-kind event, 60-plus internationally renowned health and wellness experts will share their unmatched wisdom and proven healing modalities for regulating your nervous system, switching off your maladaptive stress response, and cultivating physical, mental, and emotional well-being. We're talking brilliant thinkers and healers like Gabor Maté, Britt Frank, Dr. Daniel Siegel, Dr. Richard Schwartz, and Dr. Stephen Porges, just to name a few. Grab your seat to this free conference. You'll find the link to sign up in the show notes.
Welcome to the Healing Trauma Podcast, a compassionate guide for those seeking to heal and thrive. Introducing your host, Monique Coven, a certified trauma recovery coach and fellow traveler on the path to healing. In this podcast, we will engage in heartfelt conversation with experts in the field of trauma healing. We'll explore ways to cultivate feeling safe in our bodies and in connection to others, so that we can be present to live the life we've been given more fully and with more joy. Join us as we navigate the way towards a life restored. Introducing your host, Monique Coven.
Hello and welcome back to the Healing Trauma Podcast. My name is Leah Denton and I'll be sitting in today for Monique. Our guest today is Amber Trejo. Amber is a licensed marriage and family therapist. Amber, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to meet you and just to talk with you a little bit more. I know we kind of talked a little bit before, but excited to do this conversation today.
Too. Yeah. So you're an integrative trauma therapist. I actually don't know what that is. And for our listeners who don't, will you fill us in and tell us a little bit about where you practice and what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm licensed in marriage and family therapy, but I specialize in trauma, complex trauma primarily. And I use an integrative approach. So basically what that means is I just combine a bunch of different modalities. I'm kind of like the kitchen sink of trauma healing. Like everything that I've learned, that I feel like has been really helpful for my own journey and for my clients, I use in my work with clients. So that's like working with the body, as well as using psychodynamic approaches, newer models like internal family systems. I love that model, inner child work, things like that. So I'm just kind of integrating a bunch of different things when I work with my clients.
Okay. You want to tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to being a therapist?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up with a lot of my own trauma. And I do talk about that a lot in my content creation on Instagram. I grew up with a high amount of adverse childhood experiences, had some really deep, full wounds that I carried with me throughout my life. I did a lot of healing work after my kind of like hot mess rebellious season, you know? And as I got married and became a mom, I started to recognize that a lot of these wounds were still kind of popping up in different ways that I didn't really expect to see. And I also found myself just kind of at this place where I wanted this completely different experience for my own children than I had. And I wanted this completely different experience of even my marriage than I saw in my own family system, but I didn't know how to do that at all. So I ended up going back to school when I was pregnant with my oldest child, and I thought that I was going to go into social work, but I got my bachelor's in psychology and loved it so much that I decided to go straight on right after I graduated with my bachelor's to continue on with my master's and decided to go into marriage and family therapy. So that's how I kind of became a therapist, and I love being a therapist. And then I ended up just narrowing down into trauma as I continued to grow in my, you know, the clients that I was seeing. I was kind of noticing that there's this one type of client that really just I absolutely loved working with and that I felt like I was the most helpful with. And it was the client who had a lot of complex childhood trauma and was kind of trying to do the same thing that I was doing, like break the cycle. And so ended up getting extra training in trauma through EMDR training and just like some different trainings, you know, that you can take that can help you learn a lot more about trauma specifically and how it impacts our bodies and how it impacts our relationships and all of those things.
You mentioned that you deal with complex trauma. Around what age did you find that you fit that description?
So that's actually so funny because I had never even heard the term complex trauma until after I graduated from grad school. So I never heard that term in grad school. The school that I went to didn't have a lot of heavy focus on trauma in general. So as trauma started becoming more prevalent and I started seeing different things, I was kind of wanting to understand, like, what exactly is this? Like, what do you call an experience like mine? And that's when I became familiar with the term complex trauma. And it just resonated with me so deeply. I was like, that's what it is. Like, that's what happened to me, you know? And so that felt really helpful to be able to put words to my experience.
Yeah. It's only been a couple of years. And the first time I heard the term, I was like, no, that's not me. I don't have PTSD. I didn't go to war. But we did. We lived it.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Was there a point for you where you had grown up or moved out of your home and thought, well, that's behind me now?
Yeah. It's so funny because I have to just share this with you. I actually listened to your podcast that's on the Healing Trauma podcast because when I found out you were going to host me today. And I heard about how you had become a Christian, like in your own journey. And so for me, I grew up with a Christian faith. And in my early 20s, I moved in with my cousin. And that's where a lot of my healing did happen. But I did kind of go into this place in Christianity of just a lot of spiritual bypassing. So there was still so many things that I wasn't talking about. And I also kind of think I hid behind Christianity a little bit. Like if I could be this like model Christian woman, then I could be wanted, then I could find a husband, right? That kind of became a thing that I really wanted out of that. So I do think that during that time, I really did heal a lot. There was a lot of that that was really healing for me. And there was a lot of it that I do feel like caused a little bit more confusion and a little bit more harm.
I feel that. But do feel like that time in my life as a new believer really gave me the safety of certainty that so many trauma survivors really look for. I'm with you that it's a mixed bag as you go on. And I agree with the spiritual bypassing. So at what point do you feel like it really comes home for you where you're like, or where you notice, okay, something's not right here. I need help.
So a big part of my journey of realizing that was in my relationship with my husband. Some things. So my husband and I did not live together before we got married. And I had also never, this is the other crazy thing. I had never been in like a long-term relationship before my husband. My husband was the first one to meet my family, right? My husband was the first one to meet my mom because there's so much shame attached to my story too. And even to, you know, my mom, I was always like ashamed of the way that she lived. And I was ashamed of the way that our relationship was. And so I kind of always felt like introducing whoever I was dating to my family was just this huge thing. I was like, I always ran from it. And so my husband was the first person who I got so close to and felt safe enough to one, share some things that had happened to me that I had never shared with anybody that I had dated ever before. And then also have him meet my family members. And so, of course, as that's happening, right, even if I had healed, thought I had healed so much and everything, this new attachment, this new level of intimacy, this new level of closeness just opened up all of these other wounds that I had. And I found myself doing these things to my husband, who is an amazing man and who was the perfect fit for me, like it helped me heal so much. But I just found myself like being like, at times, like one, having this like rage towards him and just shutting down. I remember one time he told me, like, I'm the closest person to you in the world, and I still feel like you keep me at arm's length. And it was true. It was like, man, I love this man so much. And I know I still feel like I can't let him in all the way. And so it just kind of started opening doors like that, where I was like, I'm not healed. Like this attachment is so scary and it feels so scary. And I don't want to keep showing up the way that I am.
Yeah, and shameful too. I'm relating to a lot of what you're saying. And I remember it was just like being in a close and intimate relationship was like having a mirror held up to myself. And I felt ashamed. Why am I behaving this way towards somebody I love?
Yeah. And one thing that I actually was just thinking about with parenting and CPTSD, avoidance is such a big thing that survivors do. And so I know so many complex trauma survivors that they've chosen to stay single. Like they would rather be single than in a relationship, or they've chosen not to have children because, you know, there's just so much pain tied to attachment. And I get that so much. And so we can avoid so many different things, and we can actually feel really, really healed when we are outside of super intimate relationships. And I think when we get into the intimate relationship, when we start having children, right, there are so many things that it's like we just can't avoid no matter how hard we try that remind us so deeply of the trauma that happened to us.
And that's something I'd like to talk about. So how do you see in your own life and with your clients complex PTSD showing up in their lives?
I think the top ways that I see CPTSD show up in my clients' lives are in their relationships, in their attachment styles. So I see a lot of clients who have disorganized attachment. I had disorganized attachment as well. And that is basically where you really want closeness and intimacy. And when your partner is kind of like distancing themselves or something happens, you can feel really anxiously attached. Like, I need you desperately. I can't live without you. Or even like you guys have a fight or something. And then other times you're just like, get away from me. I want nothing to do with you. So it's kind of like the best of both worlds. Like you have an avoidant attachment, but you also have an anxious attachment. And it's so confusing for your partner or for anybody who you're with, because it's just like, what do you want from me? You know, it can almost feel like the person's playing games, but it's just our nervous system is kind of going into that fight or flight whenever that intimacy comes. And so we're naturally trying to protect ourselves. So in attachment style, a lot in the way that they navigate conflict with their partners or in their friendships, right? So a lot of people that I work with and with myself as well, like we're very afraid of conflict and we don't really know how to navigate conflict in a healthy way. And it feels really, really scary because whenever we came to, or a lot of clients that I work with, and I'm saying we, right? But this is a lot of survivors' experiences. Whenever they came to their family system or their parents with an issue or something like that, they were never validated. They were either like gaslit, invalidated, screamed at, yelled at, physically harmed, right? So conflict becomes really, really scary in our relationships.
Do you notice that attachment can be different from person to person? I could be push-pull, sort of anxiously attached to one person, but there are people that I have secure attachments with. I wonder if people have overarching themes of attachment, but are still capable of that being different within different relationships.
Oh, absolutely. I would say that I definitely see that. Like, for instance, disorganized for me only would come up with my romantic partners. It never came up in my friendships, really. There would be times where I would have a friendship where it would be like, oh, we're kind of like, we're close. And that kind of scares me a little bit, but it never felt as scary as it did in with a romantic partner.
I relate to that, but I've always wondered why. Do you have any insight into that?
I think each relationship triggers different things inside of us. So the other thing that I'll notice with people with disorganized attachment is if they're not in a super close relationship, they're actually able to keep most of their symptoms at bay. So a lot of these symptoms, like, so you might feel like, and I'm not saying this is your case at all, but I think a lot of people might feel like they are in a securely attached relationship, but deep down, they're still really terrified of abandonment. They're just not terrified with that specific person.
Yeah, I actually think that's a fantastic description. I think you're right. So, all right, back to complex PTSD. I'm like, oh, wait, that's actually true. So back to CPTSD and how it shows up beyond attachment. How about with, I actually saw this on your Instagram page and I was like, yeah, that's true. For a lot of us, we were left alone. I was left alone for hours, days. And even now, and I think this is pretty common with survivors, we need to be alone and to isolate, to self-regulate. And we know as mothers, you are never alone. It's loud. It's noisy. It's chaos and craziness. And I adore my children, but talk about being like a frayed live wire. I would think that it would show up like that. How do you teach people to navigate that or to listen to their bodies when they're in those situations, when it's kind of 24 hours a day, 7 days a week?
That's such a good point. So a couple of things, what you named about isolating when we're having big feelings, that's something I still struggle with. And needing my alone time, needing my quiet time, needing my downtime, I still need that. And I've learned how to incorporate that into my daily life. Sometimes I still don't do it well because I'll drive myself so hard and I'll push myself so hard, which is a normal thing that I've noticed in a lot of survivors. And they'll feel guilty for rest. They'll feel guilty for saying, I need this downtime. But the more I've learned about my own nervous system, the more I've really designed my life in a way where I've been able to incorporate like, okay, during this time, I need these 2 hours in the middle of the day to have my kind of break. I started building it in with my kids' naps, and now none of my kids nap anymore, but they all know that they have their quiet time during this specific time. And I think one way that I work with survivors a lot in this specific area is that what I notice is that they shame themselves a lot for what they need, and they don't feel like they should have needs, right? And they feel horrible about having needs because they learned through years of emotional neglect that they shouldn't have those needs. And so a lot of times they'll ignore what they need in hopes that they're doing the best they can for their child. But what I find that leads to is that they'll end up having an explosive moment. They'll end up, you know, like losing their shit. And they will just be like, I can't do this anymore, right? Because your nervous system can't. Your nervous system is saying, I can't do this. And then they'll feel just so much shame afterwards. Like, oh my gosh, I'm exactly like my parent. I'm exactly like this person. I can't regulate my emotions. And they'll feel horrible about themselves. And it doesn't help them be better parents. So what I do a lot of work around is figuring out, one, what they need, because so many survivors don't even know that. They don't have any idea what they need. They don't have any idea what helps them feel safe, what helps them feel better. And so starting to learn that, and then starting to help them understand that them giving themselves what they need and taking care of themselves, even if that means, hey, you know what? I need you, like even putting your kid on screens or something. Something that I work so much with my clients on is just like, there's no rule book for us. Like, we're trying to minimize abuse and neglect and break all of these cycles of trauma. So if we need to put our kid on a screen for a little bit longer, that's okay. So just helping parents, one, like say, I don't need to be the perfect parent. I just need to be better than how I was raised, right? And being able to give ourselves the self-compassion and the love and the parenting, really, that we needed when we were younger as we're doing it for our kids. So you know what? Like, I know I'm going to go give you rest today because you're so tired and you're such an amazing mom, right? So this would be me talking to myself, right? And what I want survivors to do, that like their needs do matter, and having self-compassion and not driving themselves into the ground. And then in turn, they will show up and be such better parents for their kids.
Yeah, it's perfectionism. When you said that, and I lost it by the time I had a third child, but with the first one, was I'm going to be attuned all the time. The screens will never be on. And really, I just wanted to be like there to meet their needs the whole way through. And it did not take long for me to realize that, no, I can't do that. And I need a break if I'm going to be a good mom.
Yeah, that was me too. You're so funny when you're like, I lost it by the third. I feel the same way. Like by the third, I just let so many things go and it was so freeing. And we do, I find this in so many survivors, that perfectionism runs so deep and it's so dysregulating trying to be perfect all the time.
Because nobody could do that. When you're working with survivors and you have a mom who comes to you and is dealing with shame or she's dealing with emotional flashbacks, where do you start?
So first things first in trauma therapy, the first thing you want to do is focus on safety and stability. And so the first thing I am trying to do with that mom is build a safe connection with her. And that takes a long time. And that's what I think is so important to remember when you are starting your own trauma therapy and you have complex trauma, there's a lot of barriers for you to feel safe in that therapy room. There's a lot of barriers for you to feel safe with anybody. And so feeling safe and starting to incorporate in small ways, you know, regulation techniques and things like that, that would be the first place that I start with my clients. And then I also always go through polyvagal theory, the autonomic ladder with them. So each response state of their nervous system and kind of explaining to them about how their nervous system works and what their story is when they're in fight or flight. What's their story when they're in ventral vagal, which is the safety and connection place? You know, what's their story when they're in a dorsal vagal shutdown and they're just like, this is hopeless. I'm never going to be able to do that. I'm never going to be able to be the parent that I want to be, you know? So being able to help them recognize each of those states and then help them figure out ways they can get into the safety and connection place more often. And in that too, explaining with them about co-regulation and how what we really needed as children was...
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again. You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
For when we were upset, when we were dysregulated, for our parent to come in and co-regulate with us. And we never had that, or most complex trauma survivors didn't have that parent who did that. And so there's a big piece of that that's missing for us, so that our dysregulation with our own children, it makes sense. We never had that loving parent that was co-regulating with us. We had no blueprint to go by. And so helping them learn that really takes a lot of the shame away, because it's kind of like, of course I'm like this. Like, my parent responded to me when I was dysregulated with physical violence. I was abused. I was neglected, right? And helping them see, like, that's why it's very hard for you to get into this ventral vagal safety and connection. And that makes it really hard to co-regulate with your own child. So helping them learn that, it's kind of the basics. And then they're able to understand about the ventral vagal space and they're able to co-regulate with their child when their child's dysregulated.
I want to back up for a second and address feeling safe in therapy. If you listen to my episode, you'll know why.
Yeah.
So some therapists will say that they're trauma-informed, which, and as a client coming in, you may have no idea what that means. It's really not your job to, when you are coming in with trauma, and trauma-informed versus trauma-trained, or even somebody who's skilled. And there is just, there's a big spectrum. For somebody who is traumatized coming in, what can you tell them to look for?
Yes, you are so right. And I think a lot of people now, as trauma's taking off, a lot of people are saying, like, yeah, I work with trauma, and even people who aren't therapists, right? Like, there's so many people out there right now that are latching on to the trauma thing. One thing I would just tell clients to look for is, what trainings do they have? Now, they could just have their degree. They could just be a licensed therapist, but they could have had training in community health, which I would say you see a lot of trauma. You do work with a lot of people who have trauma, but does that necessarily mean that you know the specifics of how to work with trauma? Not always. So I would say, like, that if someone's saying they specialize in trauma and you've had a lot of complex trauma, you're going to want to see additional training on their their bio. And that's the most important thing to look for. Also, I think a lot of people think if they're a doctor, then that's going to make them a really highly skilled, highly trained therapist is going to be the right therapist for me. So that's the other thing too. It's like, look at the trainings. The trainings matter. Like, are they trained in EMDR? Some modalities that are specifically for trauma, I would say EMDR, internal family systems, somatic work, if they've had extra training in somatic work, all of those things. So that's the first thing. And then when you get in with the therapist, how you feel around the therapist is really, really important. I've had so many clients tell me, I just didn't feel like this therapist understood me. I didn't feel like they got what I was saying. I didn't feel like we connected well. I didn't feel like we clicked per se, right? And so I do feel like there's a big part of that in there as well. Can you feel like you can connect to your therapist on a human level as well?
I agree with all of that. Okay. So I'd still like to know a little bit more about your childhood. I know you had recently lost a parent, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? Are you comfortable talking about that a little bit and what that experience is like for someone with a traumatic background when you're losing a parent who you might have had a complicated relationship with?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I'd heard you talk on another podcast about losing a parent and how you think, well, I'm an adult now, and maybe this relationship was complicated, so it's not going to be as painful losing this parent. But really, it can bring up a whole lot of stuff for you that you thought you had dealt with. And I hadn't really thought about that. And I have a parent I'm no contact with, and I feel conflicted about it. I mean, this is the right decision. I know it is. But I do think about that parent passing away and what that is going to be like. If you don't mind sharing a little bit about that experience and what you learned through it.
Yeah, absolutely. So my mom did pass away about a year and a half ago now. And I am feeling like I'm finally kind of getting to a place now where I can talk about it and it doesn't feel so overwhelming. The grief piece doesn't feel so overwhelming and it doesn't feel as deep as personal to me right now. So I feel safe talking about it, but it was very challenging because my mom and I were not no contact. We still had a relationship, but our relationship was very challenging for me. And our relationship always triggered a lot of my past wounds. Primarily, my mom was my primary parent. She was a single mom. She also struggled with alcoholism and she was very abusive, very, very neglectful. And so I think I mainly remember growing up, there was just some point in time, like I would say probably. My oldest is in fifth grade right now. So that's also very triggering because I see how much he still needs me and I see how much he still loves to be around me and needs my support in different ways and feels so incredibly overwhelmed at different situations and needs me to walk through it with him. And at that point, I just had felt like my mom was completely checked out. Like I was so doing so many things on my own after I had gone through like so many traumatic things. And my mom had been married several different times. She would kind of always go away with her husbands or her boyfriends. And then she would drink a lot. And so it was just like she wasn't around and she was checked out of parenting. And when she was there, she was very abusive and neglectful. And as I grew up, she did take responsibility for a lot of those things, but she also still was who she was. She never went to therapy. She never had the awareness of, hey, this is passive aggressive communication. This is shaming. You can't do this. So there was, it was always challenging being around her because it was like we kind of always get pulled back into these patterns. And if I would call her out, she would always kind of be like, oh, sorry, I don't kiss your ass like everybody else does or something like, you know, and it was like you get older and you heal and you are just not used to being treated like that anymore. It's kind of like, man. And then also as soon as you are, you realize you kind of become the same person again that like maybe you were growing up. I always tell my clients that we always show up as our younger selves with our parents, even if we've done so much healing work that it still feels like we get pulled back into those patterns so easily.
I have a similar situation too, where my mom is very apologetic, but damage is already done. And yes, there has been a certain amount of healing, but what that healing looks like, it's going to depend situation to situation for sure. When you sort of reconnect with your mom later, you said she moved back to your area.
I grew up in San Jose, California, and she lived in San Jose for a long time. I moved to Palm Springs. She ended up moving out to Palm Springs where I lived and living close to me for 4 years. Then I moved to Indiana. So I lived super far away from her for like 10 years. So then she did end up moving close. She ended up moving to Indiana like a year before she died. So she was close.
How was that last year with her?
So that was good in some ways, healing in some ways, and also just incredibly triggering in some ways. And you know, she had been diagnosed with lung cancer for a really long time before she got really sick. I think she had already had lung cancer for like 5 years, and she didn't do any kind of chemo or anything like that. And so when she first came back, she was just like, I'm ready to live my life, you know? And she was doing all of these things for my kids, and she was trying to be there, and she was, you know, trying to be there for us as much as she could. And she was doing a pretty good job. Like, she, you know, handled it well when I would set boundaries with her. She handled it well when I would tell her, I don't like it when you do this. I don't like it when you tell me I look tired all the time. That's not nice. Can you not tell me that? And things like that. So I felt like it was healing. But then once she got sick, it was the opposite. It was just like, here we go again. Things are going well. My kids are getting attached to you. You come to my area. And this sounds, as I say it, I'm like, is this selfish? Like, all I'm thinking about is my experience of this sickness she had. But I'm also, what I always tell my clients, like, you're allowed to feel that way. Like, you're allowed to feel that way. And so I just remind myself, like, you're allowed to feel like that, that it feels unfair, that it feels like you wish it wouldn't have happened like that. And when she started getting really sick, she does, you know, she has like the classic, a little bit of like victim stuff going on, a little bit of, well, I was waiting for you to call me. I was waiting for you to do this. And it would be like, I would try to help her. And it also would feel like she made it very hard to help her. And then she kind of got meaner as she was sicker. So it was just like the way that it ended, it was really hard. It was just not the way I would have wanted it to have ended. But I was there with her the last like few days and stuff like that. And so that was in some ways good, but also in other ways really hard.
Did you feel like you had said everything you needed to say, or did it still bring things up for you that were like, I wish it had been different?
There was things that I wanted to say to her, but I just didn't feel safe enough. And it was more of a reminder that she just couldn't be the mom that I needed, because even in those last days, you know, like, she wanted to talk about herself a lot. She wanted to talk about her marriages. And I think I just wanted her to talk about more about her experience of being a mom and say the things that maybe I had been longing to hear in some way. And it just wasn't like that.
Maybe I'm living in an echo chamber. Just feel like I have noticed a trend with that generation, that boomer trend of selfishness, of selfish parenting. Of course, not all of them, but hey, mom, you did this. It hurt my feelings. Well, I guess I'm just a terrible parent then.
Mm-hmm.
And I have been lucky that hasn't been my experience with my mom, but I've just heard so many other people where it is, or I'll see it in comments from that generation. Or maybe that's just part of the trauma spaces. You're so invalidated that of course you're going to end up with that experience and story.
No, I feel the same way about that generation in general, because I think that they have a lot of arrested development. And Pete Walker talks about it in his book about complex trauma. And I think that whatever it is about the generation of boomers, and I don't want to generalize all of them, but that there's just a lack of the ability to be able to be self-aware. I think shame runs a lot of what they do. I don't want to look at this. I don't want to face this or take responsibility for this.
Yeah, I agree. But it's so complex. I'd love to know more about your thoughts and your observations about how CPTSD shows up in parenting.
Yeah. So a lot of times the clients that I work with, and what I noticed for myself in the way that it shows up, is it's really hard for me to have compassion for myself when I do feel drained. And it's very hard for a lot of my clients to allow themselves to rest, allow themselves to do what they need to do to take care of themselves. And then the other part of the CPTSD and parenting thing is that as I started learning more about CPTSD, I started realizing that so much of it is generational. I am 90% sure that my mom also had CPTSD and my grandmother had CPTSD. And so when I think about the common themes that I saw in the way that they parented, rage is a really big thing. Not being able to control their emotions, not knowing how to navigate their emotions, not showing certain emotions or having certain feelings about certain emotions, which is called meta emotion. Even having shame around, if I feel this, then all of a sudden I feel all of this shame for feeling like this. For instance, like if a mother doesn't feel like she feels instantly connected to her child. When we first have children and all of those things begin to get triggered, all of those old wounds, it's really common to go into something like dissociation, to kind of just want to avoid the connection, want to run away from it, or not even just because of the lack of safety that we feel because we feel so frightened or scared, or the intimacy or the connection triggers so many different things. Some parents won't feel that connection to their children. Other parents get into an emotional flashback just because of the amount of love that they do feel for their child. That's kind of what happened to me with my son. I felt like I had built so many walls around my heart and so many walls around, no matter what happens to anybody, I will be okay. I will figure this out. And once I had my son, I just like get chills like thinking about it, because I just remember like looking at his tiny little body. And the minute that we got home, I just had this like anxiety attack. Of what if I do something that's going to hurt him? What if I do something and he's not okay? I can't love something this much. It was terrifying to me. So I think that can send us a lot into those emotional flashbacks and can cause a lot of things like helicoptering over our kids or not wanting them to do anything that's risky at all, not wanting them to be independent because we're terrified. But I do feel like it's one or the other of that spectrum. Like either I had a baby and I just don't feel connected to this child in the way that I thought I would, or I had a baby and I feel so connected to this child and I'm just absolutely terrified of it.
Yeah.
I've seen that too. At what stage in their parenting do you usually see them? Is there one common theme amongst them?
It's interesting because no. And I would also say that a lot of the clients that I see, they come into me and they don't necessarily come in for their parenting. They come in for things. And sometimes a lot of those things are being triggered by being a parent. But they don't really come into me specifically for, I need support with my parenting. They come into me because they're having all of these symptoms and they're sick of it. And they're like, I can't live like this anymore. And I'm starting to feel, or I'm starting to realize, or I'm starting to have these memories that I feel like I can't stop thinking about the things that happened to me as a child. And so I feel like it's usually that. It's usually the symptoms that are coming up in their day-to-day life, and they're noticing that they're dissociating all the time, or that they're having a lot of rage, they're having a lot of emotional dysregulation, and they've begun to recognize that they have trauma and that they need to work through it.
You touched on that a little bit, but I think a lot of people do spend many years just trying to treat symptoms and not understanding what's really going on with them. Can you talk a little bit about how having a child can cause and create those emotional flashbacks and what they look like?
Yes, absolutely. That's the main thing that I feel like I do work with my clients on. And the main thing I noticed about my own journey was that so much of what I was doing was because of these emotional flashbacks that I was having. And emotional flashbacks are a big part of CPTSD. And basically what it is it's like where if there was a veteran who came back home and he had this physical flashback and felt like he was right there back in the war, that would be what you would see with PTSD. With CPTSD, the emotional flashback is like, I feel emotionally exactly how I felt in that traumatizing moment. And it feels so intense. The crazy thing about emotional flashbacks, sometimes something can trigger them. And other times it's just something that happens to our body and we might not even recognize it. But the way that I will help my clients understand what they feel like is the level of intensity of emotion that you're feeling does not match at all the situation at hand. It doesn't make sense per se. So like maybe I have this pit in my stomach. I just feel like something bad is going to happen. That's something that would happen to me a lot when my kids were at the certain ages that I would have been at when something really horrible happened to me. So sometimes even if they were crying about something that was not traumatizing, say they're crying over the fact that I cut their waffle in half or something, and their little eyes are just like welling up with tears, and you see all this pain on their face, the pain on their face can send you into an emotional flashback. And it feels just like the wound of whenever you were crying like that, but it was something really traumatizing happening to you. And so then the way you react to that, the way we react in an emotional flashback is often a younger part of ourselves. So when we're in the emotional flashback, we're not showing up as our adult selves, you know, who understand what's going on. We're showing up often as like this younger part of ourselves. And so we'll feel really helpless. We'll feel trapped. These are all common emotions that will come up in an emotional flashback. We'll feel terrified, scared, afraid. We'll feel dread. We'll feel doom. And so a big part of healing emotional flashbacks is recognizing that you're in one, and going in and soothing that younger child inside of you and just letting yourself know, like, you are 39. I just turned 40. You are 40 and you are safe, and I am here with you, and nobody's going to harm you. Nobody's going to hurt you. The other time an emotional flashback can come is when your children are in that stage where they are physically violent, or they're having a tantrum or something and they hit you or something like that. So for somebody who's been hit and abused, that can be terrifying. That can send them right back into one of those moments when they were children. And so being able to understand that that happens and it's very, very real, and the things that we can do to help soothe ourselves is so, so important.
Amber, thank you so much for being here today. I appreciate you. And if people want to find you, where can they do that?
They can find me on Instagram at Integrative Trauma Therapist, or my website at www.theintegrativetraumatherapist.com. And on my website, I do have a lot of freebies for people if they want some free resources on how to reparent themselves or heal their nervous system after trauma.
Great. Thank you so much. I'll make sure to include all that in our show notes. And thank you so much to our audience for joining us today. We look forward to seeing you next time.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.